Christianity has always been a religion that is driven by the power of God. Even before there was Christianity, the religion of God was driven by indeed His power. It was His power that defeated Egypt and delivered Israel from slavery. His power enabled David to triumph over Goliath and his enemies. His power brought Israel back to Jerusalem after they had sinned and He had sent them away. And His power essentially saw them through any and all trials. Most importantly, His power was that which raised Jesus from the dead. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 19 through 21. And what is the immeasurable greatness of His power toward us who believe, according to the working of His great might, that He worked in Christ when He raised Him from the dead and seated Him at His right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion, and above every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in the one to come. Almost every word of that passage is infused with the power of God. He has also empowered the church by sending the Holy Spirit to us. And so today, as we consider the power of God, I kind of want to take a little different, well, I won't say it's different, but I want you to see this from a particular viewpoint. We live in a day and age when it seems that a lot of people have believed and want to believe that Christianity is dying out or that religion is dying out. And they like to believe that because we live in an age of modernism or we live in an age of science. Somehow there is an assumption that science can replace what religion has not really done. And we live, I think, during a time when many elite thinkers of society want to minimize the influence of Christianity. It will not work. It never has. Predictions about the death of Christianity and the death of religion have always not come to fruition. Let's just put it as simply as it is. We live in an age today that is more religious than it ever has been, in a way. Even if we live in particular communities where that doesn't seem to be the case, or sometimes the dominant voices in our society seem to want to make it exactly the opposite. I believe that Mark Twain sent the cable back from London one time when there were reports of his death, and he said, "The report of my death was an exaggeration." Several weeks ago, several months ago now, I guess, after the Colorado shooter had his day in the news, some in the news media tried to associate him with the Tea Party movement. And, you know, they found out, well, it really wasn't true, but you almost got the impression that some of the reporters, gee, we really wish it had been true because we wanted to associate him with that. Had nothing to do with the truth. There was no factual evidence for it. It just seemed to be that's the way people wanted it. I think the same can be said for the reports about the death of religion. Perhaps they're more like wishes or hoped for outcomes, but they just don't seem to come about. Sociologist by the name of Rodney Stark has written a lot of books about the progress of Christianity, about what it has done for the Western world, about how it has triumphed. His latest book was simply called The Triumph of Christianity, in which it's kind of a compendium of a number of other books that he's done. But I want to read to you some of the things that he said. Now, he is a sociologist, and he knows what his sociologist colleagues have done and said and tried to do over the last number of decades. And he suggests that a lot of these theories about the death of religion are just that. They are hoped-for outcomes, not based in fact or reality. I have to read a little bit from that, so just try to listen. This is from chapter 21 of his recent book. In 1710, the English freethinker Thomas Woolston expressed his confidence that religion would vanish by 1900. Voltaire, a French philosopher, thought this much too pessimistic and predicted that religion would be gone from the Western world within the next 50 years, about 1810 from his time. Similar predictions about the end of religion have continued ever since, eventually coming to be known as the secularization thesis. That in response to modernization, and especially to modern science, religion must lose its plausibility and wither away. The term secularization was coined by the German sociologist Max Weber. A little embarrassing that it was him, by the way, but that's okay. The namesake. Who defined it as the disenchantment of the world and, quote, the emancipation, unquote, of the modern mind from supernaturalism. For as the distinguished anthropologist Anthony Wallace informed thousands of undergraduates in 1966, quote, the future of religion is extinction. Belief in supernatural powers is doomed to die out all over the world as a result of the increasing adequacy and diffusion of scientific knowledge. The process is inevitable, unquote. In full agreement, sociologist Peter Berger informed readers of the New York Times in 1968 that the end was near, that by the 21st century, religious believers were likely to be found only in small sects huddled together to resist a worldwide secular culture. The predicament of the believer is increasingly like that of a Tibetan astrologer on a prolonged visit to an American university, unquote. Stark goes on to say, but what has most vexed proponents of the modernization causes secularization thesis is that most industrialized and scientific nations of Earth remain so very religious. The great majority of Americans continue to be active church members. And not only that, Americans show no signs of losing their belief in supernatural beings. And I might add, much to the chagrin and much to the loud voices who seem to want to trumpet otherwise. I continue. This is hardly a new discovery, Stark goes on to say. The perceptive French visitor Alexis de Tocqueville noted during the 1830s by way of the secularization theorists, quote, unfortunately, the facts by no means accord with their theory. There are certain populations in Europe whose unbelief is only equaled by their ignorance and debasement, while in America, one of the freest and most enlightened nations in the world, the people fulfill with fervor all the outward duties of religion. Basically, Stark is saying all the secularization theorists, who, by the way, are kind of among his own, in his own field of sociology, their theories are wrong. The facts do not fit the theory. And he produces mountains of evidence, mountains of statistical evidence that suggest otherwise, that suggest that, in fact, it isn't true. Now, one of the writers that I read was named Peter Berger. Listen to this. In 1997, Peter Berger was interviewed by Christian Century. Among the questions he was asked, what is your sense of whether and how secularization is taking place? In the 60s, he was one of the proponents of it. Keep in mind that Berger had long been a militant, if eloquent, proponent of the secularization theory. He answered, and I quote, I think that what I and most other sociologists of religion wrote in the 1960s about secularization was a mistake. Our underlying argument was that secularization and modernity go hand in hand. With more modernization comes more secularization. It wasn't a crazy theory. There was some evidence for it, but I think it's basically wrong. Most of the world today is certainly not secular. It's very religious, unquote. And as Stark says, and so it is. I could read some more, but there's quite a bit there, quite a bit of what he does with this, all this information to try to demonstrate that all those theories about it just are not true. And even if we just take religion overall as a general category, all the different religions, we would have to say the world is still a very religious place. The majority of people on the planet today are religious in some way or other. And we might add to that, even though in the 1960s there was some notion that they thought God was dead or not relevant anymore, I'm sorry, he's not dead either. And he's not going to die anytime soon. The 60s heard much ado about the alleged death of God. He's still alive. He's still alive. And admittedly, during this time, many people stopped going to church. But both God and religion have failed to be lost on the ash heap of modernization and scientific advancement. Those things can never replace what God provides. And I think humans intuitively know there is something more. Something that transcends the material world and holds promise for life after this one. Even if a lot of people keep trying to avoid that question, they keep trying to avoid that intuitive sense that I need something more, or they blind themselves with their sinful behaviors or whatever it is, there's still something within humanity, within the human nature, that longs for something transcendent. And we'll not even call it God yet at this point. Something more. They just instinctively and intuitively sense that there's something more. Psalm 84. Let's turn to Psalm 84 for a minute, because I want to look at a little bit of what's in there, and I think this will hopefully bring you to the point that I'm trying to get at here about how that mankind really kind of knows and depends on something more than he has within his own self. Psalm 84. There is in this psalm some very interesting things to mention. And one of the phrases in the psalm that I have, which is different in some other translations, in verse 5, it says, "Blessed are those whose strength is in you, in whose heart are the highways to Zion." Now, that phrase kind of piqued my attention, and I studied it, I looked at it, thought about it for a little bit, and it's a very interesting way to express. Basically, some of your other translations will say, there are pilgrim ways in their hearts, or they have set their hearts on pilgrimage. Excuse me. It's possible, and very likely, that this psalm would have been a psalm that was written as people, the Jews, the Israelites, would have made their way to Jerusalem for one of the several times that they were supposed to come for the major feasts of Jerusalem. And so this whole idea of pilgrimage was literally them coming to Jerusalem for the feast days, for these worships to God, for a recognition that God was the God of Israel, a sort of affirmation of the covenant. And it's very possible, if you think about it, that Jesus' family may have read this psalm on the way. Would have been one of those psalms, would have been a kind of representative of, this is what we're doing. We're on our way to the temple, and wow, this is really good. It's great for us to do this. But let's take a look at a little bit of what he says in this particular psalm. The very first thing you notice about this psalm is that there is a longing for God. The psalmist longs for God. Verse 2. My soul longs, yea, faints for the courts of the Lord. On a pilgrimage, that would be perhaps the natural feeling that we're really glad to be going to do this. But I think there's something more at work here. If there's such a thing as a spiritual DNA, and I kind of think there is, it's somehow programmed into the human mind to unite the humanity with its creator. Something went wrong when we were severed from the source of our life, when we sinned. But you see, we were created in the image of God. And because we are created in the image of God, there's something about us that wants to be united with God once again. Now, I realize here that in this particular setting, these were people who had God revealed to them. He had revealed himself to them in power. He had led them out of Egypt, etc., etc. And now they had all these laws about God, and that was part of the motivation here. But I think there's something more at work. I think humanity longs for that. They long for God. The Bible teaches we are made in the image of God. And it is natural for the soul, even one that has sinned, to want to be united with God once again. Augustine said that the soul doesn't find rest until it finds rest in God. I think he was saying something that was consistent with all of humanity. And the psalmist here talks about the sparrow finding a home. Verse 3, use this little metaphor about the sparrow finding a home in the temple courts, and man finds his home in God's house as well, verse 4. So there's this longing for God, this desire to find its true resting place. the place where God dwells, the place where God lives. In their case, certainly the temple, but in our case, to dwell with God, to have God dwell within our hearts. It's not at all inconsistent for the psalmist to talk about longing for God. The psalmist goes on further to say that God empowers their hearts, and that's where we come to verses 5 and 6. They find strength in God in verse 5. Pilgrims going to Jerusalem certainly would have anticipated God's presence because they recognized that that's where he was. The temple represented the presence of God, even though they knew technically he doesn't really just dwell in a small temple. In fact, Solomon's prayer recognized that when Solomon dedicated the temple. But it was still the representation of it. It was still all that the Jews knew about, and that's what it meant to them. And so these highways to Zion in their hearts, or these pilgrimages that they were taking, you know, they had pilgrimage in their hearts. They really wanted to be with God. They wanted to find their way back to God. And their spiritual senses here are very heightened. And again, I kind of wonder if Jesus' family didn't read this psalm on the way, or didn't at least have this psalm in mind. It's kind of interesting because in verse 6, wherever they pass somehow is sanctified by their presence. As they go through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs. The early rain covers it also with pools. It's kind of wherever they tread, it just becomes brighter, becomes a better place. I kind of wonder what that doesn't say about, or what it does say about people who are faithful to God. The pilgrim seeking God finds strength in him. Verse 7 is kind of an interesting one. It says they go from strength to strength. The actual metaphor here is they go from ramparts to ramparts, or city wall to city wall. Basically, as they're approaching Jerusalem, they get this, and the psalmist is giving us this mental picture of them going into Jerusalem. And as they pass the ramparts, they pass one, then the other, and it means they're getting closer to the presence of God. And so the excitement is beginning to build as they continue on their way. And he will go on to say that God becomes a shield for the pilgrim heart, verses 9 and verse 11. That shield perhaps would have some implication of the ramparts or walls that protect Jerusalem. And just like that, God is a shield for those who believe in him. And the pilgrim's desire is for God's presence more than anything else. And in verses 11 and 12, God blesses those who trust in him. Israel's history by now, by the time of this written psalm, was rich with stories of God's steadfast love. But I think the human heart still yearns for him. Even if you didn't know these stories, you kind of yearn for something. Even if people cannot verbalize what it is, something's missing. You go through a period in your life when you realize something is missing. All the things I've done in my life, all the things I try to do, all the things I succeed at, if you really stop to think about it, something's still missing. That's what happened in the book of Ecclesiastes. He went through everything that life could offer, and he said, there's something still missing. I think that's probably the classic text for the modern society, or many in us in the modern society. Because they go through all these things, they try to have great works, they try to succeed, they want to have this, want to have all kinds of pleasure, etc., etc., but there's something still missing. And unfortunately, they don't come to the same conclusion the writer of Ecclesiastes came to, but it in fact is there. Acts chapter 17, verses 26 through 27 is to me one of the more interesting and amazing passages, which suggests something about what God has done with human history. Listen to what the Apostle Paul is telling to the Athenian philosophers. And he, namely God, made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. See, God's active in history. It's a fact that we sometimes cannot often see because we're clouded over by all the bad things that happen in history. Somewhere in the midst of all that, God has still got his hands in the pot. He's still directing things, and the reason he's doing that is because he knows that man is made in the image of God, and that man intuitively knows he needs God, and God is saying, okay, here I am, come back. He's making it possible in some way for people to do that. It's sort of like God is promoting the pilgrim's journey back to him. He's making it better for them. And if God is doing this, is it any wonder that religion has not died? Religion is not going to die because God's still got his hand and power in the whole process. And that's why when we come to Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 12, Paul can say, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might, in his power. In fact, the entire book of Ephesians is about the power of God. And when we come to grips with the fact that there's something missing, we also come to grips with the fact that we need a higher power. We need something stronger than ourselves. And you see, God's power, according to Paul, is available here. We know that the battles of life aren't just physical battles. They're spiritual, they're mental, they're emotional. Listen to some of the athletes talking after they've just gotten through their Olympic events, or you know, they've gone through trouble and they've had to find some strength within. There's something more than just the physical going on there. They have to have a tremendous amount of mental strength and power to be able to do what they do. Do you find strength only within your own soul? No. There's got to be something more. On certain fronts, we know that we need more. And you see, what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20 is that we can do so much more. Now, to him who was able to do far more abundantly than all we ask or think, according to his power at work within us. We can do so much more than we think we can do. We have to expand our own minds to believe that the power of God is available to us. His power within us transcends what we can do for ourselves. And there's an idea of transcendence again, something beyond ourselves. In John chapter 6, Jesus says, Peter says to Jesus, where are we going to go? You're the one that has the words of life. The Spirit gives life, Jesus says. The flesh doesn't. And I think most people know how true this is. And that's another thing that draws people to Jesus. Peter refused to leave because he had the words of life. The issue of life weighs heavily on humanity. Death is a reality that we all have to face. And when we have to face death, there is absolutely no power of ourselves, or within ourselves, that can conquer it. And as long as humanity yearns for life, Christianity will never die out. Now, we know it's not going to die because God's power is at work, but I suggest it won't die ever because people know that there's something there. When they really stop to think about it, there's something there that they cannot get anywhere else. And that's hope after the grave. Those who think that Christianity will perish do not account for the power of God. Indeed, they don't even believe in it. Maybe that's one of the things that just keeps blinding their eyes to the reality of it. Neither do they understand what I consider to be the intuitive or instinctive yearning of the human heart for the one who created it. Made in the image of God, we are spiritual beings, not just flesh and blood beings. People think that technology and or science can provide for all of what a human being needs. It cannot, and it never will. They grossly misunderstand the nature of the human heart and its yearning for God. Religion, and Christianity in particular, will never die out. In fact, it is thriving. We often don't see it here because we hear the voices of secularization. The media is not going to trumpet the power of Christianity. Do not expect it to. It just will not. And there are probably large segments of our society who ignore God or want to expunge God from us, but there's also a larger majority who say, no, we think we need this. We want this. I think it's because it is inherent and perhaps somehow in our spiritual DNA. We are spiritual beings. God breathed into humanity the breath of life. It's not died out yet. And we need God to keep it going. And we know that we need God. I want us to be encouraged to know that it continues to grow rapidly around the world, even if our little corner of it, it doesn't seem to be doing all that well. It is vital, it is strong, and it is powerful. It is a power that will defeat the forces of evil. That's what Paul is reminding us in the book of Ephesians. Don't listen for a moment to those minority voices who seek to minimize its power and its influence in the world. We're not the losers of the world. We're the winners. It's not because of our own strength. It's because God's power is with us. The gospel, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ is a power beyond any available. And we want you to not only accept it, but believe it and live it. Continue to do so. It is the power of God. And it unites you to the Creator of the world, who indeed offers eternal life. Let's stand and sing.